Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Movie Addict Headquarters with your host, Betty Jo Tucker, author of Confessions of a Movie Addict, right here at www.blogtalkradio.com.
Movie fans out there. This is Betty Jo Tucker thanking you for tuning in to Movie Addict Headquarters. We have a very special show for you today, folks, because you'll be hearing a taped interview with Hugh O'Brien, one of the few remaining classic Western stars who is probably best known for portraying Wyatt Earp on TV. But he's also appeared in many movies, including The Shootist, 10 Little Indians, Come Fly With Me, There's No Business Like Show Business, and Twins. Hugh will be talking about his acting career as well as how Albert Schweitzer changed his life and his very successful youth leadership project called Hobie. Happily, with the help of his lovely wife, Virginia, Hugh has also written a memoir titled Hugh O'Brien or What's Left of Him, just in time to celebrate his 90th birthday. We're so pleased that you and Virginia took time to tape this interview with us. Nikki Starr, our producer extraordinaire, was with me a few days ago during the taping, and I want to bring her on now. Nikki, what stands out to you about this interview?
I think what stood out the most, well, there's a couple of things, but the love between him and his wife was very touching. And the story about how they met and the work that they're doing together really made an impact on me.
I agree with you. I hadn't expected that, and I was very moved by that relationship. And now, before playing the tape, I want to mention that the chat room is open. I see Nancy Lombardo from Comedy Concepts is already signed in, and we do encourage our listeners to sign up for the chat. We really appreciate them. And before we play the tape, which runs about 45 minutes, I want to call on two of our favorite film critics, Diana Sanger from Classic Movie Guide and film historian James Colt Harrison, because they recently met Hugh O'Brien in person and visited him. I understand their visit was rather lengthy at his home. Diana, what impressed you the most about Hugh O'Brien in your interview session?
Well, there were several things. First of all, it was just a delight to meet him. And, and he was just so courteous. And, I mean, you know, the man's probably been interviewed 1,000 times by 1,000 people, but he really treated us like we were very special. And he just couldn't give us enough things he had around the desk, gadgets, and show us things. But just that he was still just Hugh, you know. And at 90, what is he, 97?
No, 90.
90, mm-hmm. 90, yes. So it was just so cute how, you know, he just really took care of us. I just really appreciated that.
Well, I know how you feel because when you'll hear the interview and how polite and cordial and gentlemanly he is. And James, I'll ask you the same question. What was there about Hugh O'Brien that impressed you the most during that visit?
Well, I think his Marine training really shows. I was in the Seabees myself, which is part of the Navy, but we worked a lot with Marines. And
uh-huh.
They are so courteous and gentlemanly. And Mr. O'Brien is still like that. He's very much a Marine, once a Marine, always a Marine. And believe it or not, even at 90, he's still a very handsome man. Gray hair now, but still very good-looking and fit.
And at 17, he was the youngest Marine Corps drill instructor, 17 years old.
Yes, he was. Yeah, at 17. He lied about getting in, I think.
I think he did. And he's never forgotten that. He's really, really proud, really proud of that. And he mentions that also in our interview. Well, because Hugh's birthday is coming up in a few days, I think it's on the 19th, James, do you have a birthday message you'd like to send him?
Well, yes. I wish him many, many more birthdays because he's still a very lucid man, a very well-educated man, well-spoken. He has 1,000 stories to tell you, and he could go on forever, which he almost did because he kept us there for 4 hours, and he didn't want to let Diana go. He kept saying that she was my wife, and we kept saying, no, no, we're just friends. And he signed a picture for me. To Jim, you are so lucky to have Diana.
Great.
Well, that can still be true.
Well, it is true. Yes, it is true. But she's not my wife.
And I understand that he invited you both to his birthday bash. So I guess
yes,
I don't know whether you're planning on going or not. But he just comes across as being such a generous gentleman, and you'll hear more of the way he way he treats people during the interview that's coming up. But how about you, Diana? Do you have a 90th birthday message for Hugh?
I would like to say I just hope your day is as wonderful as your life has been. I know you're going to be with just special people who love and adore you, and the ones that still love and adore you aren't there. Just wish you to have the most blessed day you could have.
Well said, Diana. I'm sure that Hugh will love those messages. And I want to thank you both so much for calling in. You know how jealous I am that you had that much time with Hugh. But so thank you, Diana and James. And, of course, you're welcome to stay for the rest of the show. And but if not, that's fine, too, because I know if you've spent 4 hours with him, you've probably heard some of the stories that he's going to tell. But now let's hear from Hugh O'Brien himself. Just a little warning, though. Hugh and I both have hearing problems, so please be patient with us. And if you do that, I think you'll really enjoy this revealing and fascinating interview. Hi, is this Virginia or Hugh or both?
Both.
Okay. Well, this is Betty Jo Tucker, and my extraordinary producer is on the line too, and I know that she's real excited about that. Hugh, how are you today?
Let me look. When you get to be 90, which I'll be on April 19th, you got to check things out about 5 times a day. Not everything gets up. Not everything gets up at the same time.
Well, I feel the same way. I'm not too far from that myself. So I don't check that often, but I do have to check a couple of times a day. And Hugh, I want you to know that this is the first time we have ever had a guest who's an actor, a humanitarian, a patriot, and an author all rolled up in one. So you're kind of making history for our show here, and we're just so in awe of everything that you've done. I want to congratulate you on your many accomplishments.
Well, thank you very much, but I'd like to make one thing clear in the very beginning, okay?
Okay.
I am not an actor. And I have
oh,
seven shows
you
on Broadway.
You could have told me.
Excuse me. I have 7 shows on Broadway.
Wow.
33 films and approximately 450 television shows to prove that I'm not an actor.
Oh, you didn't prove it to me. I've seen some of the TV shows and some of the movies. You had just started out in Hollywood when I was just in high school, And so, you know, my heart goes pitter-pat kind of remembering those days. And
okay,
you really...
Is your husband with you?
It's going pitter-patter. So I never thought that I'd be actually talking to Hugh O'Brien, and I'm so glad that I am not. But you really are one of our few remaining classic movie stars, and I'm so happy that you did this memoir. I love the title, Hugh O'Brien, or What's Left of Him. What a great name for a book, and that shows that you still have your sense of humor. And I wanted to start out by asking you why you decided to write your autobiography.
Why I wrote the book?
Yes.
Well, because that's the only way I could get, there were quite a few people involved, but the main one, my dear, wonderful, beautiful wife, who she's the greatest lady I've ever known, and
aww,
very, very lucky to agree to marry me. But she's also the best cook in the world.
Oh,
and,
you are so lucky.
Say pardon?
You're so lucky.
I am lucky. And bottom line is that many lucky things have happened to me along the way. But the most important thing is our relationship. It really has meant a great deal to me. And I've agreed to be buried wherever she wants me to go.
That's lovely.
Well,
that is so lovely.
I think what we'll do is that we'll put the coffin, which will be made out of wood, by the way. I don't want
to be
fancy. And we'll put it at Costco and ask people to sign it, and we'll charge them $10 a piece.
You will. You're still thinking showbiz. So I understand that a friend of our show actually sang for the two of you at your wedding, which took place when you were 80 years old. Do I understand that right? Was that Debbie Reynolds?
Debbie Reynolds sang at our wedding. Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
Talk about that, Hugh.
Yeah, I met, when I was in the Marine Corps, I came up to Hollywood, to the Hollywood canteen, because they always had great food and everything. And one of the people I met there was Ida Lupino. And she introduced me to, I did the blind date program. And it turns out that there was a representative from each of the armed forces, Marine Corps, Army, Navy, and Coast Guard. And then the star, whoever was doing it on that particular show, in this case Virginia Mayo, would choose which one she would have the date with. And she asked a series of questions, and she, the final question, final question was, why do you really want a date with me? And when it got to my turn to answer that, why do you really want a date with me, Murray? I said, because, ma'am, if I don't win, I can't go back to the base. So whatever it takes. And she chose me, and we went to Ambassador Hotel, beautiful ballroom there. And first time I'd ever seen anything like that. And the next day, she wanted me to meet some of her friends, and she was doing the film with Sam Golden's studio, Sam Golden. And I went there, and she was doing a show called the, gosh, I'm trying to remember what it was now. One way or the other, it was about beautiful women and so forth. And she said, are you free for dinner? I said, well, yes, I am. She said, well, come with me, and I have a place that I'm going to take you, which I think you'll enjoy. And she took me to what was called the House of Seven Garbos, which was
the House of Seven Garbos
off of Sunset and Sweetser. And there were 24 of the most beautiful girls in the world who were living there. And
wow.
Marie Cody, the house mother, she was very, very good to them, but also very reasonable, and she was the best damn cook in the world. And anyway, after having lunch and everything, she said, where are you going to stay when you get out of the Marine Corps? I said, well, I don't really know. I haven't really decided, but I thought I'd try to find a place up here in Hollywood where all the beautiful gals are. She says, well, that makes a lot of sense. I'm going to take you to a place called the House of Seven Garbos. And she took me to this place, Sweetser and Sunset Strip. And there were about 23, 24 of the most gorgeous starlets in the world, the most absolutely beautiful. They were all in some way involved or trying to become involved in showbiz.
Yeah.
And I had lunch, and she said, wait, why don't you come here and stay here in the garage and come with me, let me show you. And she took me out in the back there, and there was this unbelievable building. It was a four-place garage, room for four cars, and storage. And she said, you can make yourself a little home here, and, you know, you could pay to use the swimming pool, tennis court, whatever. And I said, wow, that's great. So I did, and then the gals started asking me to do things, and they would repay me by, well, let's put it frankly, by making love to me. And I finally, after I lost about 48 pounds, I went to Maria and I said, I don't think I can do this anymore. And one way or the other, I got the gals to pay me in different ways rather than having just sex with them. But it was a great experience, and I still, whenever I go by that, it's now a big apartment building, but I remember that area so well.
Right, well, there. No wonder that you would. Well, how did you meet Debbie Reynolds?
How did I what?
Meet Debbie Reynolds.
How did I meet her?
Uh-huh.
I had an appointment that was set up by, I think it was Ida, for me to go meet a couple people at MGM.
Oh.
That's called Mayor.
Yeah, Uncle Louie.
She was under contract there, and I met her, and I basically said to her, I said, Debbie, you're this beautiful young lady. I ever met, and I would appreciate it very much if you would do me a great favor. She said, "What's that?" I said, "Would you give me a kiss on the cheek or forehead?" And she said, "Are you kidding? I can do better than that." And she wrapped me in her arms and gave me a great big smooch, and we remained friends ever since. She's a terrific lady, and she's also a damn smart businesswoman. But
I agree.
I consider her one of my best friends.
Well, she's definitely been a good friend of ours here on Movie Addict Headquarters, and I was wondering what motivated you to go into showbiz. Now, I was going to say to become an actor, but you don't think you're an actor, but I do. But what motivated you to choose that business?
Well, it just kind of happened. One of the people I was mowing lawns for, as I said, I had cards made up, said exterior decorator on it. And I wound up doing almost every lawn, Westwood, Santa Monica, Beverly Hills, Hollywood. I wound up having about 50 guys working for me, and one of them said, "We've got this role for you, this part, and could you do it?" And it sounded like fun. Anyway, I did, and the next thing you know, I had a lot of agents trying to sign me up, and I just decided that it was kind of a fun stop on my way to Yale and becoming an attorney. And I wound up playing attorneys and got paid a lot more, so it turned out to be a fun decision. And one way or the other, I was dating Debbie, and she was doing a show. And
excuse me, I'm going
to. I went to the rehearsal, and the leading man on that particular evening didn't show. So the director said, "Why don't you read the role? That would help everybody." And so she handed me the script. And I said, "Well, what do I do?" She said, "Well, first of all, turn it upside down. You got it backwards." when the person talks and you see your name, and right after they finish, you say your lines as they're written. And it turned out to be fun and also quite laughable for everybody because I was so dumb and stupid the way I would read it. But it was the beginning of a fun career in the business.
Well, when did your big break?
Debbie Reynolds at that time. She would have been much too young. This is when he was dating a gal that lived at the House of the Seven Garbos. And
Virginia.
He would have to go to rehearsal to see her, and then this is how this happened when the leading man was really sick, and then they asked Hugh if he could possibly fill in. And then one thing led to another, and he finally ended up getting into show business.
Well, I'm so glad that he did. Yeah.
It's turned out to be a very fun career, and I get the pleasure of talking to people like you, and all over the world. And I can tell you that my first trip to London after the show was running, I just couldn't believe it. There would be mobs waiting outside of the Dorchester Hotel where I was staying, wanting to take a picture or shake my hand or, you know, sign my name. And I just decided that the way to handle that was to be do it, get it done with. Otherwise, they would chase you all over London until they got you sitting down someplace. And that turned out to be one of the smart things that I did.
Yes.
I then went to quite a few other countries, and the show was very, very popular.
Are you talking about Wyatt Earp, the Wyatt Earp TV show?
Yes, but I also went on a lot of trips before the Wyatt Earp series, and one way or the other, whatever, I just played the game and did what I could to make them happy and smile, and I found it took much, much less time to do that than to try to say no and avoid them, because then they'd really pester you to death.
Good idea. Do you have any favorite roles that you played in the movies? Since this is Movie Addict Headquarters, we love to hear about about the movies.
I was in the, I'm trying to even remember the name of them, with I'll get it in a second anyway. He was my son, and one way or the other, he took me to meet his brother, who was also my son. It was Danny DeVito. And
twins. Twins.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Twins.
That was great. That was a great movie. I remember you remembering that. You liked working with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito.
And they were both wonderful to me. And Schwarzenegger and I became very good friends. And, you know, we just had a lot of fun together. And he was very kind to me, and I learned a great deal from him. Well, as I did with everybody I work with, I earned and learned a lot.
Well, I was going to ask about two films that I really enjoyed, 10 Little Indians and There's No Business Like Show Business. In 10 Little Indians, I think you did some filming in England on that. And I was wondering
we were in England, and we did a lot of it in Ireland, and it was a very fun thing to do. And then we were very close, obviously, to the mainland, and I went to visit, I had met a man by the name of Norman Cousin, who was the writer of Saturday Review of Literature, and he introduced me to a lot of people, and one of them that I decided to go see was Albert Schweitzer, who was had given up his life and whatever it was on the border between France and Germany. Woke up one morning and said to his wife, "We're out of here. We're going to go down to Africa and try to help the lepers." And they did, and he set up this wonderful clinic down there. And I got this letter from him saying that Dr. O'Brien's party would be welcome at any time he thought of the doctor. Anyway, I went back. I went down there and spent 9 very, very inspirational days with Albert Schweitzer at his
clinic. Wow.
And the lepers, they were responsible for powering the big warlike pirogue, which is a huge canoe cut out of a tree, large tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat in the back, and there was a paddle there. I picked it up, started paddling with them, and their chant. And one way or the other, every evening I spent 2 to 3 hours with Schweitzer in his little hut, cabin, whatever you want to call it, talking about any subject that I wanted to. And came time finally to go, and he stood between me and the river and the pirogue, the big canoe that was going to take me down to Lamborghini and to get on a plane to come home. And he just stood there, and he finally put his both hands, one on each shoulder, said, "Hugh, what are you going to do with this?" And I said, "I have absolutely no idea.
Oh.
As there's so much that I want to do." He said, "Well, let me know what you decide." And then I got on the plane, took 3 planes to get home, over 30-some hours, and I used that time to put down on paper what I wanted to do, and I focused on working with young people. I focused on 10th grade because you are old enough to travel at that age, and you've still got 2 good years in front of you before you become a senior and graduate, so that you can focus on who you really are and what is it you really want to do. But
yes,
along the way, please focus on getting a college education. One way or the other, it turned out to be what it is today. We have 98%, 98.6% of every high school, public and private, in the United States, and 10 other countries, including Iraq, who make the program available to their sophomores in high school. And then they select.
What is the name, and because of our listeners, they'll need to know the name of the project, and so I'm going to tell them that it's the Hugh O'Brien Youth Leadership Project. Am I right?
Yes, but it's abbreviated is the way we market it. H-O-B-Y.
Hobie.
Yeah, and that's Hugh O'Brien Youth. And the website.
Well, you.
Please, anybody listening, I'd love to have you look at it. You can go up on Facebook or any one of those other places, but hoby.org, O-R-G, that's the quickest way and the best way to look at it. And I would love very much for anybody listening to become part of that. And you can contribute yourself, your time. You can make a contribution because there's nobody out there being paid. They're all volunteers to run the program throughout this country and 10 other countries.
Well,
We've been able to get the cost down for the 3-4 days about $125 a school.
Wow.
So that's pretty reasonable.
Yes, so and good for you to spend your time in such a way. That's why I mentioned humanitarian, because you certainly are. And I will recommend to my listeners highly to go to hoby.org and learn more about your wonderful program and to become involved. And I wanted,
also,
since the time is going by, I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about movies, because I know that's the reason our listeners tune in is to hear about movies. So you've made a lot of Westerns, and with John Wayne, you were in his last movie, The Shootist. But I heard that you got injured in that movie. Could you tell our listeners about how that happened?
Well, number one, the Duke, John Wayne, called the Duke.
Yes.
The first time I met him was when I was in the Marine Corps. He was down in San Diego making a film. And I was going through boot camp, and one way or the other, they made me a drill instructor right after boot camp at age 17. So I'm the youngest DI, the youngest drill instructor in the entire history of the Marine Corps. I'm very proud.
Oh my
of
gosh.
And anyway,
wow.
We happened to be, I had my men in the auditorium for an event that was going to be taking place there. And he heard that's where we were. He came to the auditorium and stood there in the corner of the stage, you know, just below it. And I said, "Oh my God. John Wayne, the Duke." And I had him come up and shook hands and gave me a big hug and vice versa. And he said, I'll see you after you finish here. And I said, "Yes, sir." And we became really very good friends. And he was such a good, solid advisor when I got into this crazy business. And a dear friend. And that's one of the great things that happened to me.
Yes, except hello. Did you get shot in The Shootist? Is what I'm wondering. Did you get injured in the movie when you were making the movie The Shootist?
Not the way people would think.
Oh.
There was a scene in there that, I'm a faro deal in the film, and the guy that was playing at my table when this, which takes place in the film, the guy lost his hand, and he decided to get up and run out of there. But he did it first. He took both hands and stuffed all the money he could in his pockets and ran out. Well, in the film, I shoot him. And at that point, I know that John Wayne was the bartender, and that they were very, very possible that he might kill me, shoot
mm-hmm.
me. So I ran. He had jumped over the bar, behind the bar, and I ran to the bar on the other side, went around the corner. And in the film, you'll see this scene, which is one of the toughest I ever did in terms of stunts. I was known as a guy that tried or was willing to do all stunts possible. Mm-hmm. I felt that I could do it. But I would let the stuntman do the choreography and make sure that he got paid. And then if I felt that I could do the stunt, I did. But the one stunt that's in that film, I go running up to the bar on the other side of where John Wayne had just jumped and went around the edge of the bar, knowing full well that he was there ready to shoot me when I came around, the edge of the bar.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they had, which is what he was supposed to do. So they had this, they wanted to actually know if, I said, I'll volunteer to actually do it and do the shot so that you actually can see it hitting me. And they said, you're crazy. And I said, yeah, I am, but I'm willing to try. And you've got a very good mark here as the head stuntman. So I had marked the edge of the bar as I came around. I had marked it on my side so that if I hit my marks right, I was within about an eighth of an inch, 16th of an inch of where my head was supposed to be, and my forehead. And the guy with the gun alongside of the camera, when I came around, I was right on the mark, and he fired his gun, and you'll actually see it hit me in the film.
Oh.
And that was...
Ouch.
That was one of the most stupid stunts I've done. But it made its point.
I guess so. Well, it was kind of dangerous, and that was a fabulous movie. I mean, I really thought that was one of my favorites of John Wayne. But I'm sorry you had that bad experience there. But what about Wyatt Earp? We can't let you go without having you tell us a little bit about how Wyatt Earp, that wonderful TV series, impacted your career and your life. Is that the biggie for you?
Well, I was one of about 10 people or more that they were considering for the role. And a man by the name of Stuart Lake, who wrote the book on Wyatt Earp, actually knew him. And Stuart was the writer on our show, the Wyatt Earp series. And when they started casting around for it, he, having been a former Marine himself, felt that it couldn't possibly be any better done than by an actual Marine. And so I wound up getting the role, and also at a price I could afford. And the producers, who I always want to thank again for having my career take off, Lou Edelman, Robert Sisk, for hiring me. And one way or the other, there was a guy that came on the set by the name of Ned Buttline. And one way or the other, he had this 15-inch gun made up by Colt.
Mm-hmm.
And his name was Buntline.
Oh.
Ned Buntline. And he earned his living by writing those, what they used to call, penny dreadfuls. They were little 3x5 inch or 4x6 inch, a little comedy books that were very,
mm-hmm.
very prevalent in those days. And he had this gun made up by Colt, and he gave it to me, which I appreciated, but I didn't want to do with any of his stories. So basically, I kept the bunt line and ran him out of town. And that, the bunt line special is, well, you can't miss it on the show. It made its own reputation. And he wore it in his on his right hip, but never fired with it. It was always there just to hit people over the head if there was any kind of a confrontation. And his quick draw, his ability with that was tremendous, and he used his the left hand pistol, the two holsters, gun holster, and became pretty good and became very, very fast. And I got an offer. I was under contract Universal at the time. And
I see.
There was a guy by the name of Audie Murphy who was under
contract. Oh, yes.
And Audie was quite a character. He was a major hero
in
the war. And he wound up on a contract. And I got this reputation of being the fastest on the draw. So he, in front of a lot of people, including producers and directors, stood up and challenged me to a quick draw contract.
Really?
And I said, well, sure. He said, yes, but I insist that we use live ammunition. And I said, well, you better get yourself another guy. that sure is not going to work. And one way or the other, we finally did do the quick draw between us, but without live ammunition. And that was a fun few weeks.
Well, who did? Who won?
Beg pardon?
Who won the quick draw?
Well, we did it three times. I won two of them.
All right. Hugh, we're just about out of time, and I can't tell you how much I have enjoyed talking with you. I want to tell our listeners that so many of these behind-the-scenes stories are in your wonderful memoir, Hugh O'Brien, or What's Left of Him, and I wonder if we could call on Virginia to tell us a little bit about where our listeners can get the book. I've heard so many wonderful things. People are saying it's fast-paced, insightful, humorous, entertaining. It's just something that movie addicts should must read. So where shall they go to get the book, Virginia?
Okay, they can always be asking their local bookstores to order it for them. They can go online to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com and order it. And if they would like to get it autographed by Hugh, the only way to do that is to catch up with Hugh at a book signing or to go to Hugh's personal memorabilia website, which is hughobrien.me, hughobrien.me. So
that's
all
lowercase.
All lower, and they can order the book through us, and then Hugh will personalize it. But if they want to get it in real fast, I mean, they can just order it through Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
Well, I
one way or the other, one way or the other, I'll be happy to sign the book personally to them, or they may want to give it to their dad or whoever. I'll be happy to do as many as they want me to do. But also, I will.
Let me explain. On the website, there are 8x10 photographs of Hugh, color ones and black and white ones. And they may want to take a look at it and order one of the pictures, order a book also. So they should take a look at it and see what is for sale.
Oh, and I think that's a great idea, and I understand that the photos in the book are just great, too. So I'm so sorry that our time is up, but before you both go, Hugh, thank you for being such a great guest, and Virginia for being with us, too, and both of you, well, I guess you co-wrote the autobiography, and so I want to thank both of you for doing that. We movie addicts like me just love books like that, and what a fun and entertaining talk we've had. I encourage our listeners to check out your book as soon as possible, and I want to say best wishes from all of us here at Movie Addict headquarters, and I hope that this has been as enjoyable for you as it has been for me. And, of course, that we'll cut up there.
And I look forward to meeting you.
Oh,
are you married?
Same here.
Are you married?
And we will send you a link to this interview as soon as it is airing live. So I'll send it over to Harlan. Will that be all right? And then he'll send it on to you, Virginia?
Well, however you want to do it, you can get it to me directly, and one way or the other, I'll be happy to not only sign it, but I'd like to have you maybe come and pick it up, have lunch with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm going to have to work on teleportation for that. I'm out here in Pueblo, Colorado, so... What a wonderful invitation from Hugh O'Brien, folks. That surprised me and delighted me. And, of course, my husband and I would love to have lunch with Hugh and Virginia. And, Hugh, if you're listening, all of us here at Movie Addict Headquarters wish you a very happy 90th birthday. And I think we do have James Colt Harrison, who's been on the line for the entire show. And I wonder if he'll come in for just a second and give his reaction to this interview. James, are you there?
I am still here, yes.
Oh, thank you so much. So did you learn anything new?
Well, yes. Actually, he told you a few stories that he didn't tell us when we were at his home. And it was a thrilling afternoon of 4 hours, as I've told you. And it was, I think that's the most time I've ever spent with a movie star. And it was delightful.
Oh, well, I'm so happy that you had that opportunity, and still jealous, but at least I did get a luncheon invitation. Well, I see our time is almost up now. So I want to give a big shout out to Hugh and Virginia for being such terrific guests, and to Diana and James for calling in, and special thanks to the folks at Blog Talk Radio for their support, and to Nikki for everything she does for Movie Addict Headquarters, as well as to our chatters and other listeners. We did have Nancy Lombardo in the chat room and Kat Vecchione from World Talk Rock here on Blog Talk Radio. I hope everyone enjoyed the show, and I want to encourage all the listeners to check out some other shows, including Comedy Concepts, And I mentioned that that's hosted by the hilarious Nancy Lombardo right here on Blog Talk Radio every Monday and Friday mornings at 10:30 Eastern Time. The Mom and Pop Shop Show, you shouldn't miss that one either, hosted by Mr. Showbiz himself, George Bettinger, on Dreamstream Radio every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Plus, all the diverse shows on the Wacko Radio Network here on BTR. There's something for everybody in the Wacko wheelhouse. Please come back next time for another lively discussion about movies. And in the meantime, don't forget to check out our film reviews at realtalkreviews.com. That's R-E-E-L, realtalkreviews.com. That's all for today, folks. But in honor of Hugh O'Brien's birthday, and because he absolutely loves show business, let's go out with a special song dedicated to him. And I think you've guessed what it is. Get ready, everybody, for Hooray for Hollywood.
You see?